Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey friends, welcome to the Tennis and Bagels podcast. My name is Andre and we are finally all three of us here. Me, Vansh, Owen, we've done episodes separately. Vansh did one with T-Flank, which was pretty good. And then me and Owen, we did one with Juan Jose. And there was one just Owen and Juan Jose. And I think Owen and Vansh did a special episode with Murray Musings, just the two of them, because I couldn't hop into that call. One day we're going to get all six of us in the same talk. It's going to be complete chaos, but it's going to be fun. Looking forward to those days, to that day. Murray Musings, if you're listening to this. And by the way, I will know if you actually listen to the podcast, if you actually respond with a message to this, like say, whatever, bacon and eggs in the comments of my Twitter thing, if you have listened to this episode. Anyways, how are you guys doing?
Yeah, it's been a really long time since the three of us have, you know, got together and done a pod together, but I'm pretty excited. There's quite a bit to talk about. And this past week was pretty exciting, so.
Yeah, cool. I've been good as well. Took a little bit of a break from following tennis really closely after the U.S. Open, but really excited to be back talking tennis with you guys.
Mm-hmm. And actually, last week was actually a kind of a special week for Vansh, especially since he was at his first tournament with a media credential. Am I right, Vansh?
Yeah, that's the first time I've ever done anything. I've ever gotten a chance to go to a tournament, like actually covering it. So that was a pretty unique experience. I got to go on Saturday for the San Diego semifinals, and I also just covered the rest of it at home. Like I got to go to Zoom press conferences. I had a virtual credential. So that was a pretty cool experience. Never done that before.
Yeah. And he was with the Tennis and Bagels credential. So it's technically our first ever media appearance in an ATP tournament. So that's really interesting.
Yeah. Time for us to get that blue check on Twitter.
True. Yeah, I wonder what would happen if we applied. Probably we'd get a message that we need more followers.
Yeah.
When we can host our first space on Twitter, we're going to apply for that.
Yeah, definitely. It was a great opportunity because, San Diego Open, this is the first time they have a tournament in this area. And in Southern California, apart from Indian Wells on the ATP side. So it was... They were kind of just looking for all media members or any people that they could get to, you know, help facilitate and accommodate the players and, you know, make this a really successful event, which it was on its debut. And it really exceeded a lot of expectations that the tournament organizers had and the managing director and, all the people that were in attendance. I mean, the crowd was electric. It was a great atmosphere. And I think from what I'm hearing and what I heard in the trophy presentation at the end, it's a very good chance that this tournament will be back next year. So this could be like a reoccurring thing in terms of us covering this event. So fingers crossed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. To be honest, it doesn't really, I mean, it's kind of surprising in the sense like California is a really big hub of tennis, right? In the United States. So obviously they have the Masters 1000, but surprisingly they don't have more tournaments. I think they had San Jose this year, but that San Jose is in California too. I'm not great with the U.S. geography.
It is. It's a little bit more north. It's North California, but SoCal. I mean, that's where a lot of the best juniors come from, along with Florida. Yeah. And you have some of the best academies and best facilities here. The weather is so good, and the conditions are so good that it's very surprising that it took so many years, but finally we have it. And props to them because they had only about 5 weeks to get this whole thing together. Mm-hmm. And on such a short notice, they were able to partner with the ATP. Yeah. They were able to get, Rod Laver in the house for the final. And he presented Casper Ruud with the trophy, which was pretty special. Billie Jean King was the honorary chairman. And, you know, the managing director happened to be Danny Valverde, who's worked very closely with Andy Murray, and he was one of his coaches a long time ago. So he's got a big role in this. And then there's, just so many people in charge that put this together. They only have two courts there in the Barnes Tennis Center, which is actually a facility that I've played at many, many times. When I used to play tennis back in the good old days in the junior circuit. So it was cool to kind of go to an event and be like, oh yeah, I've played on these courts before. And I recall like pretty big matches that I've played in this kind of atmosphere and weather and conditions. And it's just so cool to see like world-class tennis. And they had such an exciting field and, you know, really, really good names that they were able to get for an ATP 250. It was probably the second most competitive ATP 250 that we've had this year, apart from Doha, which of course had Roger Federer and Dominic Thiem. And so, I mean, the cutoff for this event was insanely high for a 250. I believe it was around 45 in the world to even get in the main draw. You know, at one point, like if Kevin Anderson doesn't qualify for a main draw of a 250, you know, it's pretty, pretty competitive. So he was in as a lucky loser, but just the fact that we had so many big names, and obviously we had Rublev and Ruud, and, you know, a couple big, like we had Andy Murray in there. We had Kenya Shikori who couldn't play. And
then Shapovalov and Felix Auger-Aliassime, who actually didn't end up playing, but he was supposed to play as a number four seed, I think.
Right. Yeah. Number three seed, I think. And I mean, Shapo was fourth seed, and it was such a great lineup because also a lot of these players are on their way to Indian Wells, which will start, you know, this upcoming week. And so it's just a good destination for them to just get a few matches under their belt and just feel the conditions a little bit in Southern California.
Yeah.
Before they play in October, which is, you know, very different from what we're used to with it being in March normally. So yeah, hopefully they'll find a permanent stay on the calendar at some point. And, you know, it'd be nice if they could insert it in before Indian Wells.
Yeah.
But still talks are going to happen with the ATP and it's not completely certain yet. But I think the turnout was exceptional. There were 2,000 people that were there on both days of qualifying, and the crowd was sold out for Friday quarterfinals and Saturday semis and Sunday in the final. And yeah, I mean, there were people from all kinds of backgrounds and there were flags all over the place, Bulgarian flags and, you know, UK flags. And it seemed like people who came there really knew their tennis and really knew the background of the players. So it was really a lot more diehard fans and a good mix of just people of all ages and backgrounds. And it was pretty cool to be there in person. I actually had really good seats. So I was right in the front first couple of rows. So I got a chance to see really up close and personal with the players, and it was so great. So.
It's a great experience.
Vance, on the day that you were there in person, what was sort of different from watching on TV? Like, what little details did you notice that you don't maybe see from a TV broadcast? And were you looking for anything in particular that you don't when you watch normally?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Like, because I had such a good vantage point, I could really see the footwork really, really clearly and just how hard they were hitting the ball, which I guess doesn't always come across so well on the TV. Like, you know how hard they're hitting it, and it, you know, it comes across to a certain degree, but when you can actually see the ball just ping off their racket, like a Rublev forehand, for example, or like, you know, Casper Ruud speed around the court, you know, we know these things from watching, but it's a whole other thing to just see it like with such a good vantage point and from the side, you know? So it was really nice. I was able to take a lot of videos and really cool pictures, and just the whole display of the court and everything. You could feel that on TV with the planes in the background and things like that. But just those visuals and those angles that you get from watching it sort of court level is just a whole other experience, I think.
Just one thing before we keep going. So, like, because Owen has also been to a tournament this year, it was also his first tournament with a credential. He didn't go with our Tennis and Bagels badge, but he did also with his own blog that has been going on for longer than this podcast. So I don't think we ever got a chance to actually talk much about in this podcast about his experience there in Newport. But I think this episode is going to be interesting to just kind of have the experience that they have as media, because it's definitely like such a different experience. Like when you go and you watch so many more matches live and up close, and then you get more access to players, you get to ask different questions. So it's a whole different level than just kind of making your work in parallel to what's going on than to actually being in touch with players. So
yeah. And And I think it's cool that, I mean, we both went to 250s, but they were so different. Like Newport is on grass and San Diego is a hard court. And I guess something I was wondering about for you, Vonch, was when I went, like a big difference for me from watching on TV was the serve. Like usually I get bored by big serves and I want to see rallies. But when I was in person, the serves just like completely amazed me. Like a 112 mile an hour serve looks absolutely massive if you're like, I don't know, 100 feet away from it. Whereas on a TV, it looks like not necessarily dinky, but it doesn't look huge. And just seeing players like jump up for that serve and hit them at these ridiculous angles when you're so much closer. Like, what was your experience with that?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I actually forgot about that. The serves were really jumped out at me as well. Just the pace and the explosiveness with which they hit them. It doesn't come across so fast on TV, or the trajectory of the ball doesn't quite come through. But when you're seeing it live and you're seeing how just the impact of those serves and just the way they can come up with them so effortlessly in big moments, I think that's what always will just continue to amaze me. Like just break points down, the way they can just fire those big serves, even if they're not aces, but unreturnables, or just, you know, really good spot serves as well. Like, you know, Cameron Norrie, you don't really think of him as a big server, but he was hitting his spots really well against Andre Rublev in that second and third set. And it was just like amazing. Like, wow, how did he find that angle, you know? And even if it was just 105 and he took the pace off, but just the angles that he's able to create and just the, like, just being able to see it, right? You can almost hear the ball, like, just echo as it bounces. And that's just, it's so cool. Like, it's a different experience.
Yeah, I think kind of the sounds that the ball makes around the stadium as well. Andre, I think you'll be able to speak to this as well, because you were at the Canada tournament this year, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess something that I noticed from sort of a stadium seat is just like all the sounds you hear that like you don't get when you're on TV, because since like when you're there, you don't have to deal with the camera and like commercial breaks, you see the stuff that happens on the changeovers as well. And something that surprised me is like how close the cameras get to the players, like when they're sitting down, like they're only a couple feet away. And I think you know, that has to be uncomfortable, but it's all to get that, that TV angle. And also how loud the lines people were when they were making calls surprised me as well, because I think I'm not sure if there's a filter for TV, but when you're there and you hear them yell out, and then in between points they actually like run to the other side to get ready for the serve, so they can be lined up with the sideline, and that was actually something I didn't notice until I saw Newport in person. And so it's kind of cool to see from that angle like all the little things that you don't necessarily appreciate on TV. And you do get that like wide, beautiful angle of the court. But there's definitely a lot to be said for all the other things you get when you're in person.
Yeah.
For Owen, did you have lines people in Newport?
Like, yeah.
Was that? Oh, okay. That's cool. Cause we didn't have, we had electronic line calling.
Oh, okay.
So for us, like, you know, sometimes players would ask just for reassurance. They'd ask for the video, even though the call doesn't really change, but
was it Hawkeye or was it real bounce that you had?
I think it was Hawkeye, but it was they used the video board for that, and so at times you would hear the crowd just go because it was just, you know, a millimeter out.
We had that in Montreal too. It's like it's just like I feel like the crowd still likes it just to see like how close it was. From a TV standpoint, like I've complained about this on Twitter, like I really find like asking for the review, it's kind of BS and just like wasting time, because it's like it's not going to change the call. There's barely any, I feel like it doesn't really add any value to TV, but I feel like maybe also for the stadium is, because honestly, like under stadium, it's just sort of a totally different experience, right? Like you're experiencing something that you don't really want to end that quickly. Like whereas on TV, you just kind of feel like it's easier to disengage. Like when you're in the stadium, which is like you're part of the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
Two things that when you spoke to me that kind of resonated a lot with me, like was the out call that the lines people do, and the camera thing. Like I did training for a lines person, like right here in Quebec, so I have like the basic skills to call small matches. I don't have any experience, because by the time that I finished, the pandemic hit, so there was obviously no lines calling. But yeah, like they actually make you yell out, like they actually make you train your voice so that you can scream as loud as you possibly can. And they give like a few examples of lines people, and you're kind of like, yeah, actually I've seen this person before on court. And in a way, you just kind of like imagining yourself like how can I yell out as loud as I can so that people on Arthur Ashe, like on the loudest, on the farthest seats, could actually hear it. So it's like, it's that level of like trying to like become, because this is also a mark of a good lines person, is that like people hear you.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt in your voice. You cannot just be like out, because it's like, yeah, no, you'd be like out. I know he was out.
That's cool to hear about, because I think the lines people are a totally unexplored part of tennis in terms of covering. Like, because they're on court, they see everything, and they have to make these pinpoint calls off these 100-mile-an-hour shots that are like scraping lines or just missing lines, and they get scrutinized if they miss a tiny thing, when basically for every single shot it's like, how the hell did they know that was in or out? So it's cool to hear about that. Vonj, I guess another question I had was, what was it like being part of a full stadium? Because the first match I saw in Newport, even though this was on the stadium court, it was like the stands were completely deserted. I got to pick basically whatever seat I wanted. There were like 100 people in the stands. And I remember I was watching a match between Brooksby and Evgeny Donskoy, and they played like a pretty good rally on the first point, and basically like no one clapped. It was the craziest thing. I was expecting like a nice ovation, and it was like dead silence. So what was it like for you with like 2,000 people in the stands?
Yeah, it was awesome, because on the one hand, it's not like a huge stadium, you know, like some of the other bigger 500s or 1,000s have them. Like, you know, Indian Wells, which starts next week, that's the second biggest stadium in the world after Arthur Ashe in tennis. So, but this one is a very intimate kind of a setting. And what I liked about it is there was these close-up seats that you had, like the first four rows, where it was a lot of the VIP people or like the coaching teams of both the players. And then on the top, you had this big gap of like stairs and like a whole like tray, a whole like big squad of people just for the fans. And it was up a little bit higher up, but it was a good vibe because there was flags all over the place and there were people chanting, you know, all different kinds of chants in between rallies. There was music going on. At some point, the umpire even had to tell, you know, the MC people, like, turn the music down because it's distracting the players. And so the people were absolutely into it. Like, especially the later in the evening they got, the more drunk the people got. So you could definitely tell, like, they've been drinking a lot of beers and stuff. But in terms of just the atmosphere, I thought it was a very good, friendly atmosphere towards both the players. I never felt like it was super bipartisan, even when, you know, Grigor Dimitrov was playing against Casper Ruud. That was one of the best atmospheres I've ever seen, personally. My only complaint was that I do wish a little bit more COVID the guidelines and protocols were followed in place. Still too many people wearing their masks incorrectly, which always annoys me, or just some people not wearing masks at all. But nonetheless, it was a great, it was just such a great atmosphere for the players to play in front of. And they all just remarked afterwards about how awesome the crowd is and how much it really actually helped Grigor Dimitrov like back into the match in the second set when he was really struggling to make any inroads in Casper Ruud's game. And then it just made for such compelling and close matches, I think. And, you know, the crowd can really sway the way momentum changes in a match. We saw it at the US Open also. So it was quite electric.
That's amazing. And I think that's another thing that you kind of have to be able to appreciate in person before you can fully understand it, is like the crowd actually being able to make a difference in a match. Because when you're watching on TV, it's like you hear it, but since you're behind a screen, it's tough to really, I guess, not understand, but like fully put into like your thoughts that it is like thousands of people screaming at the players. But when you're there, it's like there are heads all around you. Like the players down on the court, you can see them. They're not that far away. And it's like between a point, like you can hear what the people are saying. They can be like, oh, that was a bad miss, or like they're not playing well today or stuff like that. And like the player is hearing most of this. And so it's like, so I think when you're there, it's much easier to understand like that the crowd actually is a factor and how tough mentally the players have to be to block that out or make use of the cheers.
Yeah, I think the thing that speaks on a lot about like professionalism and things, like it also goes in line with the sound of the ball, the angles, how crazy good they are. Because as you said, like the camera people, like they really go super close in between points. So it's not like like before and after a match, right? So like they're there and they're sitting. And I just kind of like try to imagine myself, because I got to be super close this year as well, like courtside in the final, and I was just staring at it and just imagining that was, the stadium was like 30% full, I think, in Montreal this year, which is a shame, but honestly, COVID. So we actually got lucky that we had anyone like on the stadium. So, but yeah, like when you're there and you see all those players there, I just kind of try to place myself in their situation. And I was thinking, man, I think I would just freeze because I would just get super nervous. Like there's so many people watching. Imagine if you play badly. Like I feel like yeah. it feels so embarrassing. And the camera people just like, how can you just know that you're in this massive screen, like being televised to the entire world to see, and you're just like obviously not in your best, right? Like you're all sweaty and like you're looking tired as heck and just kind of trying to focus. And like, I mean, it's definitely not like a beauty contest in any way, but you're like yeah. there's gotta be like a lot of psychology going on in there. Like, and we like to talk a lot about like tennis mentality and emotions and things like that, but and it's obviously like we're gonna get into that in a second, like about your media questions, but
you actually the amount of yeah. into a really good
yeah but yeah into in a way, like just the amount of psychological and emotional pressure that these people are, like the professionals and the elite in the world, like probably top 100, I would say, like top 200 even, like in challengers and things like that, it's too massive for us to comprehend, I guess. Like we can be on the stadium and see that up close. It's a nice perspective just to understand like that these people are definitely one in a million, I would say.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. Actually, now that you bring up the point about performance and anxiety, there's a really interesting story actually that I have. So on Saturday, I was sitting there with the first semifinal, Rublev and Cameron Norrie. And throughout the whole match, there was a guy sitting next to me. He was a big Cameron Norrie supporter. And he was just yelling after every single point, "Come on, let's go, Cam. Go, Norrie. Go, you know, come on, that's a great ball. Do it again. You know, keep it up," and stuff like that. It wasn't like coaching or anything, but it was like just kind of giving him like positive reinforcement and feedback so that Cameron would kind of just look at him and just, you know, just feel positive vibes and just get that energy and just get back into the match, because Rublev, the match was really on his racket and he won that first set. And it looked like it was going to be a pretty comfortable victory for the number one seed. But then as the match just went on, he was able to impose his game and just clear out everything and block everything out and just raises intensity, and it was quite impressive to watch. And so this whole time I'm sitting there wondering, I'm like, is this guy affiliated with Cam Norrie in any way? Because he could just be a fan, but part of me just thinks like maybe he's worked with Cameron Norrie before, or maybe he's just his mental coach or something like that. Because like he is really invested in this outcome of this match. And so I was just whispering to my brother, I'm like, should I ask him, you know, like, cause I'm really curious. and you know, on the side, I was just like Googling, like, who is Cameron Norrie's coach again? And I'm like, no, this guy is not Argentinian. It must be somebody else. And so I was just thinking like, you know, maybe I'll just wait till the end of the match. Maybe I'll ask him. I'll just keep building it up inside my brain. And then at one point, I think it was Cameron Norrie was about to serve for the match at 5-4 in the third set. And so then I just leaned over and I asked him, I'm like, so are you Cameron Norrie's coach by any chance? Like, are you affiliated with him? And he just started laughing a little bit. And he said, no, I can see why you think that. But I actually used to work with Cameron in the past. And I used to help him a lot with his physiology, with the physiology and the competition side of it. So I used to help him a lot with mental training. And we used to go through breathing exercises together. We used to go through how to improve performance, how to improve the little things that we can control. And just really the mental side of the game. It had nothing to do with kind of tactics or any technical component. It was all just about, you know.
Just tell me you got his contact number,
body language and everything. And actually, no, believe it or not, I didn't, because, you know, you only have a minute before the changeovers are so short these days.
Yeah. And then you'd have been great to have him on the podcast, but we're going to cross him for sure. Like the tennis sphere is actually much smaller than we think.
Hopefully. But I mean, he gave just me and my brother some great insight into what actually changed the outcome of that match, because, you know, just on paper, you know, it just looked like Rublev was definitely the favorite and he was definitely the more overpowering player and he probably should have won just tennis wise. But then he started explaining to me that Rublev is reacting and getting frustrated the way he is because he actually just is struggling right now to control his control what he can control, and he's getting extremely negative on himself because his body is going in ways that he doesn't have control of. And I just thought that was so interesting. So then I asked him, you know, is that really the biggest difference that you've seen in Cameron Norrie's game? And he said 100%. If there's nothing in his game that's changed dramatically, it's all about the mental work and all the work that he's put in, the behind the inner game and the and just breathing and just a more holistic, positive approach to life. And that really comes through when he's playing on the court and the fight and the most he's able to get out of his game. So I thought that was a really cool nugget and just a cool experience of just that I just so happened to sit next to him. So that was great. And after the match, he actually went and fist pumped with Cam, and it seemed like they both knew each other for a long time. So that was cool for sure.
That's an amazing anecdote. And it's kind of cool that like stuff like that can happen when you're on site, because it's cool to watch a match with tennis Twitter, because you know, everyone's a huge tennis fan, but like when you're there, it's almost like being in person with people like that, because everyone there is like a hardcore tennis fan, and some of them like the guy you talk to even have affiliations with the players. So that's amazing. And I guess like Andre touched on a minute ago with the media questions, what was your experience asking players questions? Because the first press conference I went to, I was so nervous. So I want to hear about how it was for you.
I was really, really nervous, because especially at first I was like, oh no, this Zoom link isn't working. And, you know, what am I going to do? Wait, what's the passcode again? Oh my God, he's supposed to come at 12:30. It's already 12:31. Hurry, come on. And so I eventually got in the room and I was invited, and then there were so many hands already up. And so I was like, okay, I better just raise my hand quickly and just come up with a question, you know, on the spot. And, you know, there's so many matches going on at the same time, so you're not quite always able to catch everything that's going on the other courts. But obviously you just, you know, I thought this is my first experience. Let me just kind of ask a general question. It was Federico Delbonis, who had actually just lost his first round against Aslan Karatsev. So I just, you know, came up with a question really quickly. I just kind of, I watched a little bit of the match just to get a feel beforehand, and I just said, okay, I'll go for it. And I was well aware that a lot of the people in the press room were speaking Spanish, and a couple of them were Argentinian journalists, and you know, Federico is, you know, probably going to be in a bit of a sour mood. That's probably expected. He just lost a pretty a match where he had some chances in the second set, and he, you know, he's probably upset. So I'll just respect it, and I'll just see what happens. And I just waited, and eventually I got my chance, and he was quite, I noticed if you just, you know, connect with the players and you just, you know, just adjust the way you speak and just, you know, stay relaxed and calm, and they'll respond to you because they understand, they know, they've been in press conferences before, they've done this after every loss, after every win. And so they kind of have a feel. It is a little bit difficult on Zoom to kind of get through in terms of body language and really connecting with the player and building that rapport, especially if it's your first time. But I think you know, the players responded pretty well, and I was able to kind of get my question in, which was more about, you know, how was the struggle of dealing with Karatsev, who's such a great returner, and he takes the ball so early. You know, how did you adjust to that as the match went on? And he gave a, you know, a pretty measured, nice, a good response, and I got something out of it, and so I felt pretty good. And then I realized you can actually ask for follow-ups. You can, and I didn't know you could do that. So eventually I was more prepared after that first experience. So it was pretty cool. Yeah.
I actually had a similar thing. Like my, so the first one I went to, I was super nervous. And then I asked a question, and I was like, and at first I was like, you know, I am a tennis fan and I'm talking to a tennis player. Like, this is a person talking to a god right now. And then after they responded, I was like, okay, well, they're just talking to me. We're not playing tennis. So the difference isn't that wide. And then after I understood that, I was fine. But yeah, like something I didn't realize, especially because the press conferences in Newport were so tiny, like it sounds like yours were really crowded, so much so that not everyone got to ask questions. At Newport, I don't think I was ever at a press conference where more than three journalists asked questions. Wow. And so when I told this story to Juan Jose a while ago, I requested Kevin Anderson one day, and I prepared three questions, and I was thinking like, okay, like best case scenario, I ask him all of these. And I did, because I got called on first. And then when I was done, the media representative goes, okay, Kevin, thank you. I'm like, holy crap, I was the only person who requested him. I could have talked to him for 10 or 15 minutes, and I didn't even realize. And so now that's something I know for the future, like look around, like make sure you know who else is there. And then you can sort of decide what to do from there and like which question is your most important if there are a lot of people. And if there's no one there, just keep going, you know, like make up some stuff. So that was a tough lesson.
Was your press conference via Zoom as well, Owen?
It was really weird. So there was basically like an amphitheater attached to the media room. And the player would go up there on stage. And I was in there in like one of the seats. And so I would ask them the questions from like a physical microphone, but it was being recorded over Zoom. So I would basically ask them in person and then I would get sent the Zoom link later. Vaunch, you told me that you had the idea on Zoom to sort of record the questions on your end so you could have them sooner, which is brilliant because one of the Zoom press conferences I was on actually didn't record. I asked Harlovich a few questions. And I actually don't have the transcript for that because it didn't record, so I don't have access to those anymore. And that was also smart because you then didn't have to transcribe them yourself. You could just post the clip to Twitter.
Yeah, it was surprising that they don't send the Zoom links and transcripts right away. But I guess it's understandable if it's the first event and it's logistically it might be difficult to do all of that. But I thought I thought it would be great if I could just record on my end. And sometimes there were some audio issues because obviously I'm trying to speak, but I'm also trying to record it on my phone and I'm trying to get like another copy. But it was that must have been weird because it was for you, Owen, because you were like, it was being recorded on Zoom, but you were actually there in person. So that's cool.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting. I remember the most annoying thing for me was when I would get sent the links, it wasn't like on Twitter, a lot of the time you see these transcripts where like with like the question and the answer and the person asking it is in bold and the player is in bold. And it's just like this this really neatly typed page. And it was not like that. Like they didn't send everyone one of those at Newport. I had like an audio file and I would play it and then I would sort of like type it out. And that actually took a really long time. One of the toughest things for me was like, I wanted to go out and watch the tennis, but I also wanted to like get those transcribed as quickly as possible so I could write about them because I wasn't sure I could do it later. And I remember a couple of them took like half an hour to like type out and everything. And I didn't even work them into an article. I just like put the whole thing on my blog because I didn't have time or the imagination to like do it the smooth way. But yeah, hopefully, and I don't think it works that way for all tournaments, but that was something I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, definitely the smaller tournaments are going to have like less coverage in terms of transcription, because it's, as you realize, a tough job to do. Some people required like specialized skills and specialized material that they use for that. You can actually, like, there are softwares that you can buy that will actually transcribe it for you. But you know, it's a subscription they have to pay and things like that. And honestly, like, in how many press conferences do you go to be fair, right? So
yeah, I started downloading like some third-party apps, seeing if I could do that. Yeah. And it actually, I realized it, and so I tried one. It was a free version, and as it was transcribing the voice memos audio that I'd recorded from my end, it completely butchered it. So it was not even close to what he ended up saying. And I was just like, okay, this is not going to work. I might as well just record them. And
yeah, I guess it's also tough, like with audio from players who have like sometimes a little bit like more of an accent or speak like not so great English, because honestly, like tennis is people from literally all around the world. So they're traveling all the time. So it's not like,
Vaunch, another thing I was wondering about your experience was, something I noticed was like, so the night before I did the first day at Newport, I was up kind of late doing like basic research on everyone in the draw. The draw at Newport wasn't nearly as strong as the San Diego draw. And so a lot of the players I didn't know. And I was like, got to know something about everyone because I don't know who I'm going to get to talk to. And a lot of that actually ended up being a waste because like you were mentioning, you're in this WhatsApp group chat and you kind of get messages when someone is going to a press conference. And from my perspective, it was kind of like, I want to go to as many as I can, but maybe I'm at this other match and someone finishes on another court and they're going to press and I want to talk to them, but I haven't seen any of their match. So then from there, it's kind of like scrambling, trying to figure out what to ask and that sort of thing, because you don't want to miss any opportunities. So did you have a similar experience?
I had a similar experience with that, actually, because a lot of the times they would be like, oh, you know, you were her catch is coming in the press room at 3:45. And then, you know, at 3:25, I'd be like, actually, he's here now. And I'm like, wait, what? 20 minutes early? Okay, yeah. So then you got to go in because sometimes they either show up a little late or they show up a little early. And you're just waiting there and, you know, you're waiting for them to get you in the media room. And at that point, you know, another match is going on that's, you know, maybe you want to follow a little bit more closely. That's a little bit more pertinent to who's actually going to win the tournament. And so, yeah, I had to kind of do like multitask both the things, or I just, at the same time, I don't want to miss out on the opportunity because, like, you know, you never know if you're going to be in the position again. And so I would just go in there. And even if I didn't have something prepared, I would just kind of, I knew that because I'm not as well known as some of the other journalists in that Zoom room, that I'm probably not going to get called on first. And so I just had a little bit more time then to kind of come up with a question or just review a little bit of the match through point by point stats or things like that, or just what I've always wondered kind of about their game. And then maybe just look up some basic research just so you don't look like, you know, you're totally aloof about what happened.
Yeah.
But yeah, you would definitely have to scramble. Like, it's not nothing is really like fixed. And so the more well prepared you go, the better, but it doesn't kind of just know, guarantee results right away.
I guess you have to really define your scope, right? So like, you have at least like in my head, I could come up with like three reasons to why you would pick a player, and one of them would be like they're, as you said, like a top player that you'd expect to go far into the tournament. The second reason would be like it's a player that you expect to do better in the future, so like a younger player who's like up and coming and you want to talk to them. And the other reason would be like they're from your country and then you just want to cover for them, right? And that's one of the reasons why, for example, I don't think you were able to talk much, I guess, with Chapel, because Matchpoint was there and they needed their content for their media, right? So they're obviously going to like stick with Chapel as much as possible, right? So because that's like that's where they win their content, right? And as you also struggle with Andy Murray, big media have like bigger slices of the pie when it comes to like big players. So and Andy Murray is a totally different situation nowadays, right? Because like he's a wild card, like ranked outside of the top 100, but he's Andy Murray. But you got to talk to Casper Ruud, who's actually a top 10 player and won like three titles back to back this year. Is what, his fifth title this year or fourth?
Yeah, fifth title of the year. Yeah. First on the hard court. You know, he's never lost a final this year. He's now probably going to make Turin, probably going to qualify for the year-end finals. And yeah, he's had a really good year. He was probably the most impressive player for me this week, and such an eye-opener to actually how much more there is to his game than I realized.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he is just casually labeled as a clay court specialist, a clay court grinder. And, you know, I mean, the stats kind of, you know, show that. If we're being honest, like, he's just basically swept a lot of clay court 250s, and he's, you know, made a couple of Masters 1000s, and all of his best results have come on clay, but slowly he's starting to show that he's really becoming more of an all-court player and just kind of rounding into that skill set. It's reminding his trajectory, actually reminding me a lot of, even though they have different ceilings in terms of their power and explosivity, but a little bit of Dominic Thiem sort of 5-6 years ago when he was starting to finally like win smaller tournaments on a hard court and just build year after year after year. And then eventually he won the US Open. So I feel like, you know, Ruud with his mentality and just the way he competed this week, and he went through, this was by far his most impressive run. He beat three top 30 players and Andy Murray to win this title. And, you know, he did it off the back of, he played the Laver Cup with those other five top 10 players. So I think that actually gave him some good experiences to practice and hit a lot with those guys. And he won a match there at Laver Cup pretty handily against Riley Opelka. And he'd even bageled Riley Opelka before the US Open started. And he's, you know, he'd had some good results on hard court before, a couple of Masters 1000s. And actually, I realized there's a lot more to his game. He can really volley. I didn't know he could volley so well. I mean, I knew he had good hands, but just the way he was able to transition and his transition game, it was pretty impressive throughout the whole week. And then he could stay, his defense was so great on the slices. He was doing a really good job of just tactically. He was digging. He's super fast. He covers the court really well. He does the two-shot pass really well, which, you know, as Murray is, you know, getting older and he's coming back from these injuries, he's trying to net rush and come to the net a lot more. And so because of that, Casper Ruud was really using his, he was really taking a deep return position, but then he was getting so many balls low on passing shots at Murray's feet, and then just getting a second ball to hit after that with the two shot pass. And he did that so well throughout the whole week, just really just doing such a great job of counterattacking. And he's so quick and he anticipates so well. So I was very impressed by just how much of an all-court player he's really becoming. And then just actually how much more charisma he has than I realized. Because he was quite a bit of a crowd favorite, even against Grigor and even in, definitely in the final. He had a lot of Norwegian support and he had a lot of, he stayed so long after the matches and, you know, signed a lot of autographs, took a lot of selfies. And I think he's going to be really popular now in San Diego and in Southern California. It's so great because, I feel like he's really embraced the whole hardcore thing. And
when you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
He's really kind of just taking it in his stride and he's proving that he can kind of play now on both surfaces. And he was a real eye opener for me this week. I must say, I was pretty impressed. Yeah. He even did a tweener once mid rally out of nowhere. He just went.
I remember that. That was one of the few matches I was able to catch a bit of.
Yeah. And then he also did a saber at one point against.
Oh, really? That's hilarious.
In the quarters. And he's just like, oh, yeah, I can do that too, huh? Nick Kyrgios, look at me. So it was great. It was awesome. Yeah.
That's funny. That's cool that you're now mentioning the tennis now, because if we're moving on to the actual tennis of the week, I guess in a way, you already said, Rud impressed you. And I guess you can maybe chat a bit. Or if you, Owen, as well, if you have any insights now, ahead of Indian Wells, not less big tournament of the year, but probably the biggest. Well, I guess the ATP finals are still on, but
I still don't know how seriously to take that tournament.
The ATP finals?
This is tennis paradise, Indian Wells, and it's often called the first major. It's a combined event. So I feel like that's
probably the biggest Masters 1000 of the year now coming up, at least on hard. And, two things, I guess. One, how did you find that you obviously have been to other tennis tournaments before, so it's not your first live tennis tournament, both of you, but how do you find that this changes your perspective on maybe ahead of Indian Wells, the players that are playing now, how do you see how do you see the players now, and especially maybe Andy Murray and his chances maybe of getting more than a couple wins in the same week.
Yeah, I'll defer to Vaunch on this one, because Newport, as fun as it was to watch, the field was not super, super top level, and it was also on grass. So I think the players who played there are not going to have as much relevance to how Indian Wells goes. True. I'll be interested to see how Brooksby does. He was runner-up in Newport, had a great US Open, a very fun match with Djokovic. So I'll have an eye out for him for sure, but I doubt many other players in the draw are going to make a splash.
Yeah, unless Anderson really comes back from... which I don't think so. But.
Yeah, I mean, Indian Wells is going to be very interesting this time of the year, in October. Definitely the courts are a lot slower and grittier, but the ball travels pretty fast throughout the year, so it actually can accommodate a lot of different play styles. But I find that the best clay court players, they also tend to have a good amount of success, and so do the best servers, and so do the best all-court players. So it's a really good mix. And, without the big three playing this time, and with Medvedev having just won the US Open, I think, frankly, he's going to be pretty motivated to perform well, because this is a tournament that he actually hasn't done very well in the past, because he just hasn't had a chance because it was canceled last year, and he is the number one seed. This is the first time Indian Wells, I believe, without a big three since 2000. So it's been a really long time.
That's insane.
Yeah, and so Medvedev will be the top seed there, and you know, I guess you're looking at those top five, six players, but like Miami, we saw without the big three, and you know that was pretty interesting. And so you have players like Hurkacz and Ruud and Berrettini, and you know the other usual players in the top 10 that we know. But it's it could also lead to some pretty big breakthroughs and some upsets, I think, like this time of the year. But I think also San Diego is a decent indicator for, like, I think Casper Ruud, I think he'll really love the conditions there. He spoke a lot about it in his press conference, actually, how much he's looking forward to finishing the year really strong, and how he isn't feeling super tired yet, because he's had a, you know, he lost relatively early at the US Open. So that gave him a lot of time to just kind of build up and get back into shape. And he's in really good physical condition right now. And obviously he has the confidence from winning San Diego, and he will be seated pretty high at Indian Wells. And, you know, I would not want to play Casper Ruud at Indian Wells in these kind of conditions, especially with how confident and how big he's hitting the ball right now.
A next step I would love to see for him is, now that he's won this tournament, how will he do against sort of the cream of the crop of the field in Indian Wells? Because I think Medvedev is a really big favorite there. Like, I don't think there's anyone who, like, I would give a solid chance to beat him. So I want to see Ruud play like Medvedev or Tsitsipas and see how he stacks up against those guys, because I think that is where you go next. I think he's maybe not as far along as Rublev in that on that track, but I think he's on the same track where you know, you're starting to win some smaller things, but the next step is going to be determined by, like, can you beat the guys who are at the very top?
Yeah, that's pretty well said. Like, it's kind of like Rublev last year. You know, he won five titles, and he mopped up a lot of 250s and 500s. He kind of beat everybody he should beat, but now it's the real test against the best of the best, to sort of in the quarterfinal, semifinal stages of big tournaments. And there's a small sample size. He did play Tsitsipas in the quarterfinals of Canada, and he played Zverev in Cincinnati, and those weren't very competitive. Yeah. So now with this win, and every week he seems to be gaining in confidence. So it should be interesting to see what it looks like when he plays some of these guys. And even had he played Rublev in that final, that would have also been interesting. It would have been a good kind of barometer to see where he stacks up against the best players. But yeah, and you know, apart from that, I'm looking forward to that race, because there's four guys actually, with Felix, Ruud, Hurkacz, and Sinner. And they've all had pretty good seasons, and they're all trying to get those last two spots. So I guess that's a big motivation for all four of them. Yeah. And I guess Shapovalov, but he's pretty far away. He pretty much has to win Indian Wells to have a real shot. So
yeah. Shapovalov, like, said in an interview that he doesn't necessarily have Turin as a goal. Yeah. But Felix is really set on trying to achieve that.
It was really unfortunate. Felix was on site, and he was ready to play, but he just got injured, you know, the day before, and he had to pull out. He would have played Grigor Dimitrov. It was nice to see Grigor Dimitrov playing really good tennis again. That was another big takeaway for me. I was like, this guy has so many of the best ingredients. He is so good when he's on. It just reminded me of 2017, just watching him. Even though he didn't beat Casper Ruud, he did really well to get himself back into that match, and he produced some great shots, and he sustained it for a good period, and he got three or four really big wins. It's been a rough year for him, because I was looking, he was injured in three of the four slams. And, you know, he had built up some momentum, like, kind of before COVID started. He reached the semifinals of the US Open, semifinals of Paris. He was starting to get his ranking up.
Yeah.
And then he caught COVID, and then it just kind of went downhill from there for parts of the year.
Yeah. So. I mean, Australia, it really looks like he was going to make the semifinals. Wasn't he up like 6-1 on Karatsev and then got hurt or something?
Right. He was up 6-2, and he was in a good position, but then he hurt his lower back. So that's, yeah, and he had just beaten team the round before. And
I remember that match. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I said on Twitter, it always frustrates me, but when Dimitrov plays well, because it's like, this guy is so talented. Like, when he plays well, I mean, obviously there are things you can pick at in his game, but like, the serve can be good. He's so athletic around the court. He moves well, defends well. The slice is one of the best. He's good hands. I mean, his backhand, it's one-handed, so you're always going to be able to target that side. But I think he hits it down the line almost as well as anyone. He doesn't have the raw power of teams, but he hesitates less really to pull that trigger more than, like, less than pretty much all the other one-handers. But it just seems like something is always going wrong in his game. I think I tried to make the comparison that, like, his Achilles heel is that anything can be an Achilles heel. And But yeah, it's always good to see him playing well, because he's one of the most dynamic players to watch.
Yeah, for sure.
He's one of those players that just has so many options in his game, because he mixes up spins and heights, and he does a really good job. The versatility on the backhand is great, but also he has such a great wrist that he can half volley a lot of shots.
Oh yeah,
like passing shots, right? You just flick it down the line, and
strongest wrists on tour probably. Those like stretch one arms passing shots he hits off both wings, or the strength is just ridiculous.
Yeah, and some of those shots are just so ridiculous to pull off, and he does them. He makes it look easy actually when he does it, and then he lacks a little bit of potency on the forehand, just finishing. Yeah. Just the finishing power is not quite there.
I would imagine that is. I would say it's not necessarily he doesn't have it, but he doesn't necessarily resort to those shots. Like it was a problem right in the beginning, I guess, of his career. Like not his career, but like when he was starting to come up to the top levels of the game, is that he would rally infinitely at times and just rely on just athleticism to win points, instead of actually sometimes doing what he can actually do and actually take advantage of his power and dominate points. And oftentimes you would see him running around and winning incredible hot shots, but you don't want to win an entire match like that, right? You want to.
That's so right.
I
remember watching him play Medvedev. I forgot what tournament. I think it was Toronto. And they were playing, and Dimitrov was hitting these forehands that were very good, but they weren't aggressive enough to do anything against an elite defender. So he would hit these shots that were kind of close to the line, but not that close. And so they would just come back deep. And I'm like, you can't win a match like this. You need to make that forehand the biggest shot on court. And he just seems kind of hesitant to do that. Like, again, he'll hit them sort of close to the corners, but not far enough into the corners to really boss around, the elite players. And so the match I'll always point people to was that 2017 Australian Open semifinal with Nadal, where he basically played out of his mind the entire time. And unfortunately for him, he still lost. But that's a good example of what he can do with his forehand, because he really went after it that day.
That was peak Dimitrov. That's the best match he's ever played in his career.
I mean, everything was loss. Firing. He was close. He was 5 points away from winning, 2 break points at 4-3 in the fifth. He end that year ranked number three? Or he was number three at one point that year. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he finished the year. He won the ATP finals. He finished Cincinnati that year. He won 2 other titles and he finished the year number three. And
yeah, he's got the game. I don't think his game has lost that many layers. Like, he can still play very well. But it just depends on him. And that's the problem.
Yeah. And you know, he has still got a few years. Like, it's not like he's super old. He is 30 years old now. But I think with that, he can also just be relaxed, because there's not as much spotlight on him now. You know, it's more on the younger guys than the sort of 20 to 25 year olds. So, you know, he can definitely get back to the top 20. It just takes a couple of 2 or 3 really strong weeks in bigger tournaments. Yeah. And
who knows? He can pull off a Varinka and win majors at over 30 years old. He pulls it off together. I feel like maybe his body isn't as strong as Wawrinka was, because he didn't get as injured, not as much as he did and who knows what COVID is gonna hold for him in the future. Hopefully not hopefully he's gonna have no setbacks from the disease, but
I think just because of one-handed backhands, just because of how much they're so adored in the tennis universe, and just how much people just attach to them, and just how evangelical they can just look and how beautiful they look. I think it's just...
All right, let's move on.
Because of that media narrative, I think it just reels us all in. I think we're all guilty of it, because it's just...
Yeah.
When it's firing, it is just so great to watch, but it's also... It has its downsides, because shot selection errors and just, you know, there's just so many things you can do. You have to pick the right shot at the right time, and that's where it becomes tricky, because his game is almost just... It has so many ingredients, but it's kind of just missing he's kind of just missing the meat and potatoes sometimes, and that's just... It can be frustrating for him.
Yeah, I think I mean, you guys know I hate the elegance narrative, but watching him hit a backhand winner down the line is one of the prettiest things you'll see on court.
Right.
In my opinion, I will say, because it is subjective. Yeah. But you look at his game, and a guy like him should have a great serve plus one game, but it's the serve is shaky enough that he'll just have horrible days. Again, sometimes he's not aggressive enough with the forehand. And if you don't have that, it just puts so much pressure on everything else. And Andre put it so beautifully when he said sometimes he just has to try to win a match with hot shots, and you can't do that. It's almost an Alex de Minaur thing, where it's you're going to win these ridiculous points. The crowd is going to go crazy. You will be all over YouTube. But it's 1 point. You cannot rely on stuff like that. Yeah.
And then there's, he's playing a guy in, you know, across the other side of the net who is so steady and maintains his level all throughout. You know exactly what you're going to get from him. Mm-hmm. Whereas with Grigor, it's a lot more of the ups and downs, and he just kind of has to navigate and just find that middle ground. And I think that's the most challenging part. But regardless of it, it was a really great week for him, and so he should he should build on it.
And interestingly enough, like Miami and Indian Wells were not back to back this year, but they somehow like suffer from the same big three-lessness and you know, big names in a way. But like, obviously Medvedev has just won a Grand Slam, so that makes everything a little bit more different. He's almost challenging for number one. He has a chance, I believe, for year end. Although Djokovic is, if he plays well and if he decides he's gonna go for the seventh year in number one, it's possible that he's gonna do it. He's very driven, so I feel like this is a bit of a bigger challenge than winning the U.S. Open. Even though winning the US Open was obviously a massive challenge. But how do you guys rate Indian Wells right now as to what Miami was? Because Miami just kind of felt like a free-for-all. And we had like Tsitsipas and Rublev and players like this. And you're like, this is your chance to grab your biggest title of your career. And Hurkacz ended up doing it. Like, nobody really expected that to happen. Do you guys see that, you know, the lack of, you know, anticipation for Indian Wells as much as we did for Miami? Because Miami definitely felt like a glorified 500 this year.
I think on the ATP side, definitely. WTA totally saved Miami. Because you had Andreescu coming back, playing all those marathons. Barty was playing super well. That was my introduction to Sara Cerebes Tormo. So I think for me, that tournament was all WTA. I watched the Hurkacz Sinner final, and I thought it was awful. I thought it was one of the worst matches I've seen this year. Yeah. I thought they both played so badly.
Was it better or worse than the Monte Carlo final?
Oh man, that's tough. I mean, Monte Carlo, I live vlogged, and that was a painful experience because Rublev did not have a single break point. So yeah. I think on the ATP side, I'm more excited for Indian Wells than I am for Miami, because I think Medvedev crashed out of Miami like 6-4, 6-2 to Carreño Busta. I don't think that's going to happen again. He destroyed Carreño Busta. Right? Oh, wait, was it? Oh, yeah. You're right. Batista good. I think Medvedev.
I get them confused all the
point.
Time. So
yeah, and that was, I remember that because he was a chance that everybody was thinking like maybe it's Batista Good's chance to win because he got like a roadblock that was Djokovic so many times, right?
Yeah,
so.
who did Batista Good lose to in Miami? I don't even remember.
Wasn't it
Hurkacz?
Was Sinner.
Sinner in the semi.
Oh yeah, they played a good match, right?
That's true.
So I think now that Medvedev has sort of won his first major, added yet another Masters 1000 on hard, I think like he feels more of even more of a solid favorite now. So I'm excited to see what he'll do. I'm excited to see how Tsitsipas is going to bounce back from the US Open. Because I think he needs to get a good result on a Masters 1000 on hard. He has not done a ton on Masters 1000s on hard court. His first and only final in that category was in 2018. So I think it is past time for him to make another one of those. But yeah, I think I'm more excited for the WTA because that US Open was incredible. I think now for me, it's all about like, what's Raducanu going to do? Like, what is Fernandez going to do? Like, can they possibly continue the form they were in? I think other players are going to be mad that they missed out on that chance at the US Open. So I think like Sakkari and Sabalenka are going to be out for blood. Players like that, Svitolina, who
Sabalenka
lost
already.
Oh yeah, that's right. Sabalenka is COVID. Because she didn't get vaccinated. Anyway, let's not get started on that. but yeah, I think players like that who sort of lost narrowly or lost in a late round are really going to be looking to make a push here.
Yeah,
and because like we were saying, Indian Wells is a huge title. I think some would probably rather have Indian Wells than the year-end finals, even though it's fewer points. So I just can't wait to see like these heavyweight clashes in third, fourth round. See like what unexpected names make great runs. So I think I'm going to be more looking to the WTA side for the great matches. And on the ATP side, I'm more going to be thinking like, what's Medvedev going to do? Is he going to back up what he did at the US Open?
Yeah, I think it's a little different now in terms than Miami, because Medvedev now has this huge aura on hardcourt where he's just won just about every big title, except for Australian Open, Indian Wells, and Miami. So I think, and I think he's pretty motivated. He'll be pretty motivated by that year in number one. And I've already seen videos of him training at UCLA, like pretty intensely. And he seems pretty like, you know, like he really wants Indian Wells. And then, yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, Tsitsipas, what does he do after losing in the third round to Carlos Alcaraz at the US Open? And then Sinner, who just won a title this week. How did those guys sort of, who are just on the edge of qualify on the ATP side, you know, how many points do they pick up and how close are they to actually secure that spot? Because that'll be kind of interesting. Hurkacz won Miami. He likes playing in the States. He's, you know, in pretty decent position to qualify. Same with Felix. And then Ruud, I'm interested to see how he backs up San Diego because I watched him so closely. I'm interested to see if, what kind of a draw Andy Murray gets, because a lot of his results will actually just depend on the draw and just, you know, how he can, you know, just bounce back and how many matches he can win. And then the WTA fascinates me because Fernandez is coming back, Raducanu, and just all the hype around her still in Great Britain and all around the world. And she's just taking it all in her stride and she's going to play more events after Indian Wells. And, you know, it's going to be a shock to the system for everybody if she loses first round, but it really shouldn't be because that's just you know what you should expect. She has so little experience at this level and she's just catapulted like eight levels to finally win a major, and this was her second main draw of a slam, her fourth WTA event, and you know was the US Open. So it's absolutely crazy, and if she starts building momentum, she could also realistically qualify for, but let's not get too far ahead of ourselves there.
She's still looking for her first win at a non-major event, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, which so is
non-major WTA event, yeah.
Yeah.
It's absolutely
It's one.
And there's Ash Barty playing, and there's no Aryna Sabalenka. Naomi Osaka is still struggling with her mental health.
Yeah, and Barty and Sabalenka have been two of the biggest names of the year because they had that rivalry.
Yeah.
I mean, on clay, a lot of it for that first half of the year. And so now I think, cause I think if Barty were playing, she might still be the favorite. I think like, even though between Barty and the fields, like you pick the fields, it's still tough to pick against Barty as that one favorite, because I think even though Raducanu won that US Open in such dominant fashion, it is tough to pick her as the favorite because it's still like, okay, like that just happened and it was absolutely amazing, but maintaining that high of a level seems like a totally different task.
I don't have a favorite for the WTA. Yeah.
And then you have Pliskova just kind of like poking her nose, like in like the top player in the elite. Just kind of, she got like two big wins over Sabalenka, got a couple of finals this year.
Yeah, she's already qualified for Guadalajara, the top four.
Yeah, you know, so like this, she decided not to play even Billie Jean King Cup just because of that. So you see the intent of her, like, to actually try and do well, like, in those tournaments. Yeah. So,
I mean, Pliskova is someone who I have trouble getting a read on right now because her year has been her best one in a while. Like, like Wimbledon, she won that amazing semifinal. And in the final, she wasn't that far away from winning. And I don't even think she used the right game plan. I thought she went way too much to Barty's forehand. So, like, I think it wouldn't have been out of the question for her to win that. And then at the US Open, she went deep as well, but then she lost in like this really weird flat way to Sakkari. And so I'm kind of like, is she back at the top to stay, or like, can we rely on her yet? So I'm going to be interested to see how she does as well, because we know the peak is still there.
I think we can still safely pick her to make a quarterfinal. And I think winning the tournament is kind of like a big question mark, but like if you were to pick her to like make quarters and semis, I wouldn't be surprised. To be fair and the ATP, like the one thing for me is like Andy Murray, like, just speaking necessarily, like, not necessarily about Indian Wells itself, but like him, I feel like if he can get two wins in a row and like beat a seeded player and then like follow it up with something, or beat somebody and then follow it up with like a seeded player win, which is probably the most likely outcome that it's gonna face. I think he's gonna maybe just say like, hey, I can do this for more than two matches in a row, right? So I feel like this is kind of like going to open it up, the opportunity for him to like break back into the top 100, maybe the top 50, and like maybe win a couple tournaments out thereafter. I'm not sure if he will ever get to the level of like competing for Masters 1000 again. Grand Slams is definitely something that we don't want to discuss right now, because honestly, like, where is Andy Murray right now to win a Grand Slam? I don't think it's something that is that valuable to the discussion of Andy Murray. And in terms of the WTA, like, Raducanu and Fernandez, I think they're in different positions right now, because Fernandez has been more consistently at the WTA level. She was ranked higher than Raducanu in the US Open. She has won her first title this year. So it's not like players don't know her. Like she's been there. She's played a couple of big players before. But Raducanu is still sort of like a question mark. Like we've seen a peak Raducanu like playing incredible tennis, which is something that you supposedly shouldn't be able to hold up for too long. But like it's like, is she going to keep going? Like when is she going to lose a set? Like whereas for Fernandez, like, okay, is this a level that is going to be maintained? I am hoping so. And I think she's got it. I think she's kind of like unlocked something in her game that like she needed. A couple wins in a row that obviously like reaching the final, beating top three seeded players, like I think two top 10 players and on the way four.
Three. It was like three top five players. Which
three
is
top five players.
Absolutely insane.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. But like, yeah, it's gonna be so interesting. And to be fair, like before I call any tight lists for Indian Wells in the WTA, I just wanna see who this first week, like who does well, like in the first two rounds, like where those players that we look at them and see like, hey, they have big future ahead of them, how are they going to do right now?
Yeah.
Right, so
yeah,
I just want to see that right
now. A
couple
other players that come to my mind for Indian Wells as we were just talking, I you know, there was also a WTA event going on in Chicago and I didn't get to, you know, watch it much because of my San Diego experiences, but we had a final with Muguruza and Jabeur, and both those guys were kind of on the edge of qualifying for Guadalajara, and they're kind of been top 10 players this season. But it was nice to see Muguruza pick up a title because she had been playing supremely well in the first 3 months of the year. She realistically could have won the Australian Open. She had two match points against Osaka in the fourth round, and that didn't go her way. But she then won Dubai. She reached the final of another event, lost to Ash Barty before the Australian Open started. So she's done. And then she got injured in Charleston, and then her results were a little bit affected during that whole summer. But she's really turning it up. I think her consistency has been pretty big this season for her. And she's had quite an interesting career. Like she's won 9 titles, but I think only two of them have been on hard court, which is pretty, only two of them have been on surfaces other than hard court, which was the French Open and Wimbledon that she won. So that's pretty,
two best
pretty
ones.
Wild to yeah. think about. Yeah. Cause she rarely ever just turns up and wins small titles. All of her titles are like slams or they're 1000s, and she's won 9 of them, which isn't, you know, an insane amount, but now she's starting to win more than one in the season. So I'm curious to see how she backs it up at Indian Wells. And then also same with Jabeur, because she's had an amazing year too. She's won 44 matches this year. She's like 8 or 9 in the race, and she could actually qualify, and she's, you know, super electric and fun to watch. And she was up a set in a break in Chicago on Muguruza, yeah, and that just completely flipped. So
yeah, that was a match I wish I had seen in full. I watched the highlights earlier, and from I think 6-3, 3-2 and a break, she lost 10 games in a row to lose the match. And the highlights really only showed a few points from that stretch, so we don't really know what happened, if she lost focus and couldn't regain it, or if it was a physical thing. Because I think, as good as Muguruza is, I don't think it was as simple as Muguruza started playing better and that was enough for like that total dominance. I mean, because Jabeur has produced a couple of the best performances of the year, like at Wimbledon, her match against Swiatek, I think she lost the first set 7-5. And then after that, she was untouchable.
It was the same thing against Muguruza round before. It was those two matches against Muguruza and Jabeur were insane. Like both times she lost the first set 7-5, and then she swept the next two sets.
Yeah, I mean, she was hitting these ridiculous shots from all over the court. I was talking to Vaunch before this episode started, and the highlights, there were a couple of points from the first set against Muguruza where she was pushing her from corner to corner so effectively that Muguruza was just getting shoved into these crazy positions on the court. And so Jabeur could do whatever she wanted. I think she hit like this casual cross-court slice backhand winner, because the court was so open. Like it was a slow winner. That was how well she had like opened up space on the court. And like, yeah, her court craft is amazing. She can hit these ridiculous winners from outside the doubles alleys. The drop shots are obviously a huge weapon.
A drop shot and set point. Oh my God.
Oh yeah. 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 That, I mean, yeah. I remember thinking that, and I was like, she telegraphed that drop shot. Like it was high, like you knew it was coming. And yet it had so much backspin that like it was unreachable anyway. It wasn't like one of those Djokovic drop shots that like barely clears the net. It was like like, again, she advertised it, but it was so good that, like, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
She has the talent to pull those shots off. It's just,
yeah.
You know, if you do it so many times, it becomes predictable, and it's just, it's tough to win a whole match with shots like when you have so many of those in your bag. It's just, if you, I guess, against a player like Muguruza, is because she's so dialed in and locked in from the baseline, and she has such good length on her ground strokes, I'd imagine if you, you know, again, we don't know what caused that big drop off, but my sense is that it wasn't completely all physical. It was, a lot of it was mental as well. And she just, she had one bad game where she got broken back and she just got a bit discouraged. And that's all it really takes with the tempo that Muguruza brings from the baseline and the relentless firepower off both wings.
Yeah.
It's just, it can be too much sometimes. And,
yeah.
you know, it's crazy because Jabeur has it. She has all the shots.
She has it all. Yeah. I think, Jabeur can fall victim of her own game in a way. It's like if she can produce those shots, yes. But like at the moment that she may lose the confidence, as you said, like it can go like a bad stretch of like maybe 3 to 4 games where she's playing badly and try and drop shots where just not.
It's also one of those where it looks really, really good. And then when it's on, and then it can look terrible when it misses.
Yeah, because like the drop shots sometimes they just fall like way too far from the net, right? So like they just become like easy putaways, and she starts getting too down on herself. But like when she's locked
they become
in,
become bailout shots. Yeah, and that's where it's.
Yeah, she's dangerous when she is playing well. I mean, it sounds dumb to say, but like there's a lot of players that are playing well that you can still see a way to beat them. But like Jabeur is a player that like can be, if she's confident and she's focused, she will play well, and she will play her shots well, and she has so many shots that she can play that it will keep the opponent guessing just too much. And she also has a big serve, I find. Like it's something that is not necessarily talked about as much because obviously drop shots are far more flashy, but she has a serve that she can get to, like, not necessarily the level of Barty level, but like in a way she can use it similarly, which is not a speedy serve, is not like booming serve that's going like 120 miles per hour, but she can place it really well. She can disguise it really well. And she has a lot of like slice on that shot too. So like,
she can inject pace out of nowhere.
True.
That too. In the middle of a rally, she can just go really big down the line on either side.
This might seem like a bit of a weird comparison, but I feel like with all her options, like sometimes when she's playing well, it almost reminds me of Federer, where it's like when he's in full flow, it's like everything he touches turns to gold. It's like, you think his backhand is a weakness, like he's going to hit winners off of that. And like when they're playing well, it's like they look unstoppable. But then when they're not playing well, it's kind of like everything can also go wrong. It's like, because sometimes Federer will just like shank a rally forehand, which is like his biggest strength. And sometimes with Jabeur, her biggest strengths can let her down as well. And so I think like that astonishingly high peak is there. But it's the floor that needs to come off.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, it was nice to see Sinner not lose a set in Sofia and just win that title. But he did have some ups and downs kind of in between. I still think his serve can improve a little bit, and he still has ways to go. But 4 titles in 11 months, that's pretty good consistency, I'd say.
What is his ranking right now, currently?
12, I believe 13? He's 12 or 13, but in the race, he's 10. And it's actually 9 because Rafa's probably not going
to play. So not too far off. Like last year, I think we were talking to Steve Flink, and
both of you
are saying like he's going to, I think he's going to be number like top 10 by next year, by the end of next year, which will be this year. So not there yet, but still a couple tournaments to go.
What strikes me about him is just he's not really so keen on achieving milestones and title. Obviously he's doing that, but it's more about the bigger picture with him. And it's more like incremental improvements. That's what I've seen from Sinner. I think that's the encouraging part. His performance against Sasha Zverev was not so great at the US Open. It was a bit disappointing. But he bounced back well now, and he's won a title. And he part of the reason was also he was just physically so spent by the time that match came around. So he wasn't able to play his best. But I think this week, you know, the match against Monfils was very straightforward. There were no breakpoints chances that Monfils had, and it was a clean 6-3, 6-4. He was just the better player. So that's pretty encouraging. You want to win matches like that. It's also nice to see Monfils playing some good tennis because he's pretty good for the sport and he's entertaining. And I think I saw a stat from Enrico that he's reached 17. This is his 17th year in a row that he's at least made a final.
Yeah, he's only behind Rafa, right?
Rafa has 18. So that's you know, he wouldn't expect him to be on the list like that. But that's the smaller 250s in France, and he's always there for those.
This crop of players who's sort of just outside that top eight with Chapeau, Ogier Aliassime, Sinner, and like a bit Hurkacz as well. Like, they really interest me because ranking wise, they're not far away from where they need to be. And yet, I think I kind of feel like if you look at their results in the majors, it still feels like they have a ways to go. Like, I think Chapeau, out of all those guys, he's the farthest away from making the year on finals, right?
Yeah, he is. He's even behind Cameron Norrie, even though Shapovalov made a semifinal at Wimbledon.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. I think that semifinal at Wimbledon is the most impressive thing any of those guys have done all year. Like, I think like him playing Djokovic that close. But I think at the same time, the thing that tells me that they're still kind of far away is like, it was close, but it was still straight sets. Like, it's like that they're taking their steps, but there are so many steps to go.
For me, it's the other results after that, you know, losing 7 of the next 10 matches. I think it's just, it's one of those things that Chapeau just has to, he has to still calibrate that, you know, because week in, week out, it's not surprising for me because I think it's just kind of never been Chapeau's thing to be so consistent week after week. And just, you know, he's never going to be like a Norrie, you know, for instance, and just clock in and get to all those 250 finals and do that. But he's going to have weeks where he's going to be absolutely amazing, like Wimbledon.
Yeah, I wonder if it's also the pain from that loss, because what he said after the match, like, that told me, like, he expected to win. And yet, like, and he played better, probably, on average. It was just he lost every big point. And so I think that's, there's a lot of scar tissue from that. So I wonder if he's still
recovering. He tried to get rid of that scar tissue pretty quickly, and he opted to skip the Olympics, and then he just played a clay court event in Stade. And, you know, I thought, I felt like that was a questionable decision at the time, but then
there's no big clay tournaments for the rest of the year.
Yeah. So, I mean, so he just has some figuring out to do, but he's kind of the same player we've always known. And so that's where I'm still waiting to see that little bit extra improvement. But the good news is he's still young and 22, and he already has a major semifinal. Not many players can say that. Right. Mm-hmm. And same thing with Felix. Not many players can say they have 8 finals, and it's just,
crazy with Felix too, that he's hit his best Grand Slam result at Wimbledon, and then he reached the semifinal in the very next slam. He got a little bit of help from Alcaraz's probably like too many matches, and like he had to retire due to injury. But like, I feel like Felix was really, he was also winning, he won the first set. I think he could have won that match probably in 4 Alcaraz was to finish it. He sadly didn't play like his best tennis against Medvedev at all times, but I feel like he could have been real danger if he had won that second set, honestly. Yeah, like he has a ceiling that is very, very high. And I am expecting great things for him in the future. We'll see what happens at the end of this year.
So pretty exciting, I guess, to
I wasn't sure how much we were going to have to talk about, but yeah, I'm very excited for Indian Wells now.
Yeah, it's that's what happens when we bring all the three of us together. Like,
got to keep to a tighter schedule and do this again next week.
Yeah,
it's so much fun. Also, shout out one last thing. Shout out to Alison Van Hoytbank. I think that's how you pronounce it. Hoytbank. She won her 5th title of the year. She's never lost a final, and she beat, it was in Astana, I think, she beat Yulia Putintseva. So good result. She lost the first set and came back and won. So, I think she's had some big results before. She beat Muguruza, I think, at Wimbledon when Muguruza was the defending champion. Got to about the 4th round. She's made it French Open quarters before. She's pretty, you know, she's got some nice finesse. Her game really would suit like indoor hard courts and grass really well. Mm. And she really brought it against Putintseva, who was pretty frustrated afterwards and just kind of like threw her racket. She was pretty angry. But, dang. Because it was her hometown and she was so close. She was up a break in the 3rd set. But just wanted to throw that in. So congratulations to her.
Yeah. So I guess that will cover it for this episode. The first one since I don't even know when, like Wimbledan, that we did an episode together.
I think so, But, we also made a video.
And then...
We made a video for TikTok tennis, right?
And then we did that, yeah.
Oh yeah, and I think just before the Wimbledon final, men's final, we did a video together.
I think so.
Yeah, that was the last one.
Man, I can't believe we didn't do one during the U.S. Open.
Yeah, it's like everything was just too hectic, especially on my end with the Canadian doing well, the Canadians doing well. We actually, let's not forget Dabrowski. We had three Canadians in the semifinals. And a very, very sad injury from Stefani in the semifinal in the tiebreaker. She tore her knee ligament. So that was pretty sad. So hopefully she's going to be back. And I don't know if many people that are listening to this podcast know I'm also Brazilian. So I was double frustrated with that, with that loss. So hoping Indian Wells is going to be great. It was amazing to talk to you guys. Let's definitely do this more often now that we...
Looking forward to many more of these chats, honestly, with the three of us.
And thanks for sharing so many stories from San Diego. That's a really fascinating, like, first half of this.
My pleasure. It was great to represent Tennis and Bagels and get that credential and also compare it with your experiences from Newport. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Hopefully one of us will be on site for another tournament soon.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
Expecting that the blog article soon, Vunch, from San Diego.
Oh, yeah. So, I'll try my best to put all of that together. Yeah.
We all have stuff to do in our lives,
time to start emailing the credential people in Melbourne to get to one of those.
Yeah, let's get the Australian Open. And we forgot to end the episode, but with the magic of editing, you can still follow us at Tennis and Bagels Podcast, and Vansh is at Vansh2k, Owen is at Tennis Nation, and I am at Rolandberg Andre. Thank you for listening. See you next time. Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.